It's good to see you all. Good to see some new faces. And for those of you who are new, I am one of the teachers. We have a team of teachers who rotate through bringing gifts of teaching and thought and study. And it gives you a chance to get different perspectives, which we kind of have come to value. We like it. It makes us think. And I've always said that the last thing in the world I want to do is to be in a world of just me, because then I have no other perspective except for my very narrow one. So we kind of like that. So what you hear this morning will be my perspective. And we are going through the book of Mark slowly, on purpose, because we want to really chew on it and see what it has to say to us. So, this morning as we go through the Gospel of Mark, which is the good news that Mark wanted us to know, things that he thought were important that not be forgotten. They're wondrous things, important things, things that will help us establish and grow in our walk with Christ. And today we are all the way up to Mark 7, verses 1 through 23. And this particular passage doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. There's not a lot of miracles. There's not a lot of marvels, things like that. It's more basically a look at faith and practice. And it offers Jesus' teachings and corrections about how the Jews were doing the things that they did. So one might ask, what does this have to do with us? Well, maybe you've heard the seven last words of the church. We've never done things this way before. And I would venture to say that none of us like change. We like things in our little box, that things that we're used to, and it's always the same, and we don't have to think too much. Or maybe that's just me. But Jesus seems to love rocking boats, doesn't he? And that's sort of what the Jewish folks in Jesus' day had fallen into, a bit of same old, same old. Remember, prior to Jesus' arrival on earth, the Jews had been in what is called the intertestamentary period. And that is basically, for us, a simple page turn from the Old Testament to the New, right? But what we don't seem to remember much is that that period between the two testaments is 400 years. And not only is it 400 years, but it's 400 years of relative silence from God. So there's no prophets, nothing in terms of direct revelation. 400 years of basically trying to follow God as best they could from what they had heard in the past, from forefathers and what they had experienced. Now, before we dive into Mark's gospel, there are a few contextual things that you're going to need to know in order to understand kind of what's going on. And as I discuss these issues, I'm going to try to relate them to us a little bit, something a little more familiar to us, and things that are present in our culture, so that you see that this is not just something where we can point a finger at a they, but we need to turn that finger around and point it at a we. And as you know, anytime there's a metaphor or analogy, it's going to break down. So when I give an analogy, please don't look at it as gospel, but rather as something that assists us in our understanding of a culture that is so very, very different from ours. Okay? So the first thing, and many of you know this, is that the Jewish church leadership contained various groups. There were the scribes, and these were the masters of Hebrew law. The writings, they gave themselves over to diligent study into copying the varying manuscripts and things. There was actually a very high demand to prepare copies of Israel's sacred literature on scrolls, and many devoted themselves entirely to preserving and copying these scriptures. Thank God they did. The scribes, however, don't feature very much in our story, so we can say goodbye, scribes. Then you have the Pharisees. Now, we hear about these guys a lot. This sect emerged around 150 BCE and promoted the idea of priestly purity for all Jews. The Pharisees taught that beside the commandments, the oral law was also passed down from Moses. While the Sadducees' worship was temple-centric, The Pharisees taught that God could and should be worshipped away from the temple and even outside of Jerusalem. To the Pharisees, worship consisted not just in sacrifice, but in prayer and in study and in the practice of God's law. They believed strongly, very strongly, that all Jews should observe the rules and rituals concerning purification. Finally, there were the Sadducees, and these folks were sort of considered the elites. While there were fewer Sadducees than there were Pharisees, they were more powerful, more influential. They were tasked with overseeing the responsibilities of the temple, and it was from the Sadducees that the high priest was selected. Their focus was the defense of the law of God, and they looked to Moses' teachings as authoritative. They rejected miracles and the supernatural power of God. But for this story, we're going to focus primarily on the Pharisees. And the Pharisees taught that worship of God can and should be practiced outside the temple and in everyday life. And the primary way of doing so was by observing the rules and rituals and by keeping ceremonially clean and pure. Now, on its face, that doesn't really sound so bad, does it? I mean, don't we say something familiar or similar? I mean, how many times have you heard from this very pulpit that our faith needs to be lived out as much on Wednesdays as it is on Sundays? We need to include God in our everythings, our work, our relaxation, our relationships, our recreation. And the way we do that is by pursuing the things that draw us into God's presence. You've all heard that, right? I hope so, because we've said it. So when we hear about the Pharisees in the upcoming passage, let's not think of them as a they that got it totally wrong. Let's look a bit deeper and see what parallels we can draw on our own ways of doing things and use that as a cautionary tale. Well, let's lighten the mood a little bit. Have you ever wondered what's the first thing you're going to do when you get to heaven? Now, let's not get distracted by questions of what is heaven. Let's just go with the old metaphor of walking through the pearly gates past the angels and St. Peter, okay? I mean, that's how I was taught. It's probably not right, but we're going to hold on to it this morning. And of course, we're going to spend the first good chunk of our time worshiping God. But let's say you take a break and you wander around a bit. What do you do? Well, I tell you one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to find a Pharisee and I'm going to apologize to them. Because, considering the culture, it probably would be a hymn, honestly. But that Pharisees tend to get a bum rap. It's easy to paint them as getting things completely wrong and leading others astray, which they did. But then we tend to feel pretty good about ourselves because we're not them. But aren't we? I mean, personally, I don't think I'm one to cast stones. So we're going to hold a bit of grace for the Pharisees this morning. They were doing the best that they could with what they understood, just like we do today. And we can learn a lot about how to do things from the Pharisees and how not to do things from the Pharisees. Okay, the next background piece we need to look at is Jewish law. And it comes in several chunks, as it were. First, we have the Torah, and basically that's what we know of as the first five books of the Old Testament, or the Pentateuch. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, everyone's favorite, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Torah is what the Sadducees planted their flag in, the teachings of Moses. However, the Torah brings up many questions in terms of living it out. Think of it this way. It all began with the Ten Commandments, handed down by God to Moses. Then, as Moses and his brother Aaron presented them to the Israelites, they gave interpretations and extrapolations as to how these Ten Commandments would look in the context of life. So enter the Torah, or what we know of as the Pentateuch. 613 extrapolations in all, in the form of commands. And I got that from a book, I did not count. Which, over the centuries, created more questions as the culture changed from a semi-nomadic group of wanderers to people inhabiting and defending the promised land under various forms of government, prophets, judges, kings, and ultimately a people who were divided, dispersed, held captive, and nearly eradicated. Eventually, they were allowed to return to the Promised Land, rebuild the temple and the walls, and began to grapple with their identity as a people, and more specifically, a people of God. And when they entered the intertestamentary period, which included, for reason God only knows, 400 years of relative silence, there were a lot of questions. Do you see how many cultural shifts they went through? It is so easy for us to lose sight of that looking back. We tend to think that the culture was the same in Genesis as it was in Jesus' day, but it wasn't, not even a little bit. So as a result, the Torah was further developed and expanded by what we call oral tradition, the way things were done. These oral traditions were known as the Talmud and were passed down from generation to generation. However, as the Jews continued to be harassed and conquered, many of their rabbinical scholars were killed. While there had been initially a resistance to writing down the oral law, because, you know, it was oral, in order to ensure its preservation, it was eventually decided that it must be codified or it would be lost. So around 200 BCE, a man called Rabbi Judah determined to codify the oral tradition, which is known now as the Mishnah, and it's a 63 tractate or dissertations setting forth the oral laws, systematically codifying them and arranging them according to topic. So if you want to know about the Sabbath, you go to the Mishnah, and it tells you everywhere that you go to find information on that. You know, I found myself really wishing that this was Wayne Randolph's week to teach, because he's the Hebrew scholar, not me. I was the music major. But but I do work in a Jewish law firm, and this gave me kind of we have a few Hebrew scholars there. And so I kind of pumped them for information about how these things worked out. And this is what I came up with. So if it's incorrect, you can correct me later. I will apologize, but I will also blame them. The point is, the law began small with 10 commandments. And then it expanded via Moses, responding to the need for application to life, the commandments found in the Torah. And as culture changed, oral traditions arose to explain how to live in the Torah in today's context. We've done this here in America. We have the Constitution. It begins with a preamble, which probably most of you had to memorize in high school, right? Who did? Who remembers it? Okay. I wrote it down. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Sound familiar? I hope. Essentially, there's five precepts upon which the rest of the Constitution points. And that's sort of like the Ten Commandments were the basis for the Torah. That the establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Pretty much everything else hangs on that. But those precepts required explanation and guidelines on how they were to be carried out. Ergo, the rest of the Constitution, which kind of outlines how the nation will govern itself. And almost immediately, the Bill of Rights was added that consisted of the first 10 amendments, bringing further clarification, and eventually more amendments were added, and probably still will be. So now we have the equivalent of the Torah. However, things arose that needed deciding, disputes or calls for further clarification. So various lawsuits were filed, and courts made decisions that would eventually become binding on all similar situations. This is called the doctrine of stare decisis, and if you ever go to law school, you'll thank me for bringing that up. Consider this the oral law. And these case decisions have been codified into various volumes that fill up various law libraries in the nation. So see, it's pretty much the same. We do what they did. But what about church? Well, Liminal is not a church that leans heavily on a body of written laws. however some denominations are. Now, Ben and I once belonged to a church that looked first to the scriptures, but then they had what they termed as the manual that comprised their oral traditions. And the manual included, in addition to many other things, a list of behaviors that were considered to be inconsistent with one who followed God. And this list of behaviors was built on things that were going on in the current culture. Now, this denomination was found in 1908, and it was an offshoot of the Pentecostal movement. So part of its oral tradition encompassed things they wanted to retain from the Pentecostal movement and some things they wanted to move away from. It also encompassed various things from the current culture that they saw as inconsistent with what a Christ follower would do. And in 1908, the culture was making a subtle shift from an agrarian society to a more progressive industry-based economy. Travel was more accessible, so the family-centric base of operations was challenged. New leisure activities were coming to the horizon, and the 20s were right around the corner. So church fathers, and probably church mothers as well, began looking at their church with dismay. And their children, they saw them exposed to drinking, smoking, hanging out with more secular youths at pool halls, bowling alleys, roller skating rinks, dance halls, swimming pools, and even, eventually, movie theaters. Oh, we got trouble. So when they began to set down their rules and their regulations, those things made the forbidden list, and there it stayed. So when in 1973 I applied to college that was run by this denomination, I was asked to sign a statement of faith of things that I would not do. Among them, roller skating, going to movies, dancing, smoking, drinking, engaging in mixed bathing, which means going swimming in the presence of the opposite sex. Now, some of these things in the 1970s were kind of silly. And there are also things going on in the 1970s that I think you would be able to list that were conspicuously absent from their list of two don'ts. I need not enumerate. And you see the problem, right? The culture had shifted. The oral tradition had not. Now, the original intent of the oral traditions, both Jewish and those closer to home, were good, to guide us to pursue the things of God, things that honor God, what we do, what we refrain from doing, what distracts us from God. It doesn't take long, though, for the intent to be lost and for the focus to be squarely on the behaviors rather than on the intent. The next iteration is almost as damaging. It becomes, as long as you're not doing those things, you're golden. Forget about the intent of your heart. Forget about your motivations. Just don't go bowling, and you'll get an express ticket to heaven. That can't be right, can it? Well, the Gospel of Mark, Jesus says, it is not. And I bet some of you were wondering if I ever actually would get to get the Gospel of Mark. But wait no longer. We're going to dive in right now. And hopefully the background I've just given you will give you a context. So, Mark 7. Then the Pharisees turned to talk with Jesus, and with them came some scribes and scholars from Jerusalem. Upon seeing the disciples eating, the Pharisees said, "Your disciples are eating bread with defiled, unwashed hands." Now, you know that the Pharisees, and all the Jews for that matter, held the tradition of their ancestors that their hands must be washed before eating to avoid being ritually unclean. Likewise, they washed when they returned from the market and followed similar purity teachings as well, from washing of their food to the washing of their bowls, cups, and kettles. This is, by the way, the voice version. The scribes and Pharisees continued, "Why don't your disciples follow the traditions passed down to us? Why do they eat their bread with defiled hands?" Jesus responded, "Isaiah prophesied wisely about your religious pretensions when he wrote, 'These people honor me with words off their lips. Meanwhile, their hearts are far from me. Their worship is empty, void of true devotion. They teach human commandment, memorized and practiced by rote.'" He continued, When you cling blindly to your own traditions, such as washing utensils and cups, you completely miss God's command. Then, indeed, you have perfected setting aside God's commands for the sake of your tradition. For instance, Moses gave you God's commandment, honor your father and mother. And also, if you curse your father or mother, you will be put to death. But say a man says to his aged parents, I've decided that the support you were expecting from me will now be a holy offering set aside for God. After that, he's not allowed to do anything for his parents. Do you think God wants you to honor your traditions that you have passed down? This is only one of the many places you are blind. He then said to the crowd that had gathered, Listen, all of you, to this teaching. I want you to understand. There is nothing outside someone that can corrupt him. Only the things that come out of a person corrupt him. And all who have ears to hear, let them listen. When they had come in from the road, his disciples asked him what he meant by his teaching. Jesus said, Do you mean you don't understand this one either? Look, whatever goes into people from outside can't defile them because it doesn't go into their hearts. Outside things go through their guts and back out, thus making all foods pure. No, it's what comes from within that corrupts. It's what grows out of the hearts of people that leads to corruption. Evil thoughts, immoral sex, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wicked acts, treachery, sensuality, jealousy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All of these come from within, and these are the sins that truly corrupt a person. Now, something to remember here about Mark's audience is primarily to non-Jews. Likely he's writing to Roman Gentiles, and that explains his explanation about the washing of hands, that all foods are declared clean, which it turns out is very helpful to us. Now, to a Jewish audience, the comment about clean hands, that would have been something they would have cut their teeth on. Well, there's two points upon which the Pharisees and Jesus disagreed. The first is over cleanliness and purity. The conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees can be understood by examining these points. The concept of uncleanness reflects more the oral tradition than the Torah itself. Exodus specifies that priests are required to wash before entering the tabernacle. Aside from that, the washing of hands was only prescribed if one had touched a bodily discharge. So in reality, the Pharisees' accusations that the disciples were eating with unclean hands could only have been sustained on the basis of the Torah, but not on the basis of the Torah, but on the basis of their oral tradition. While the Torah leaves washing of hands at that, the Mishnah actually devotes a full 25% of questions of cleansing and purity. The Mishnah calls oral interpretation a fence around the Torah, meaning that its purpose is to preserve the integrity of the written law by elaborating every conceivable implication of it. In other words, it's prescribed in infinite detail how the intent of the Torah was to be fulfilled in all circumstances. That's kind of what the manual from our former denomination was trying to accomplish, but it falls short and it misses the point. And here's how it plays out. Now, I'm going to get personal. Do any of you drive a Tesla? Anyone? Hand up. Raise it high. Okay. So I'm not going to offend anyone. Because I'm going to use a Tesla as an example only, not to represent, no disrespect to any of you who may now or in the future or in the past or any time possess, own, lease, inherit, borrow, or any other form of possession of a Tesla, or this is not meant to in any way impugn Teslas, their creators, builders, designers, promoters, employees, professionals, or any other person or entity associated therewith, including many others, Elon Musk specifically. I told you I work in a law firm and I have no interest in getting sued to make a point. So, there's a slippery slope. And here's how it goes. We start with a commandment. It begins with a premise. Let's say God says, do not covet. We extrapolate. The premise is then extrapolated or applied to life and culture. I should not covet or envy others. Envy means I'm jealous or I want what someone else has. Envy unrestrained means I just might take what does not belong to me. Envy leads to selfishness, acquisitiveness, greed, avarice, etc. So then we take a step beyond the intent. But in my culture, everyone has a nice car, so I should have one too. In fact, I deserve it. God wants me to have good things, so I should have a Tesla. It's only right. Then we get the distortion. People will think that I am righteous as long as I give pennies to the poor and give something to the church. And people will think God has blessed me if I have a Tesla. And if I don't think about it too carefully, I'm going to think that too. And then we come to the perversion. I love my Tesla, which I don't have. But let's say, I love my Tesla. In fact, I'm a bit obsessed with it. My focus is on keeping it clean, making sure people see me driving it, taking up 2 parking spaces so the doors don't get dinged, and resenting my neighbor when his Tesla is a newer model than mine. Do you see how far the actual practice can get from God's original intent? And do you see how insidious it is? Is owning a Tesla a sin? No, a Tesla is a car. Perhaps it's even a reasonable car, if you can afford it, and if you keep it in its proper perspective. However, when it becomes a status symbol for you, something in which you gain your identity, your joy, and then it takes the place of God, who should be our sole source of adoration, then it becomes an idol, which breaks not one, but 2 of the Big Ten. So the second point upon which the Pharisees and Jesus disagreed is the contention between tradition of the elders, or it concerns the tradition of the elders. Jesus takes issue with the ever-evolving oral law that had begun to take on equal authoritative precedence with the Torah. This shift to oral law contained the inherent danger of focusing on peripheral matters that either obscured or perverted the intent. Jesus' feelings on the subject are illustrated by his sarcasm in verse 6. And don't you love that Jesus can be sarcastic? That is one of my favorite characteristics of him. That and grace. Grace is good. So he says, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions." He goes on to call them hypocrites, a term he takes from the theater, meaning to play a part on the stage. Now, see, in Greek theater, the actors would wear various masks. They didn't have a ton of actors, so maybe an actor would play several parts, and you'd know who he was by the mask he was wearing. And the masks would be according to the roles that they impersonated. And that's the image that Jesus uses. They have religious masks on, so they look religious. But that is not reflective of who they actually are. Jesus states that it is what is on the inside that counts. He pronounces that nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it's what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. Now, we know when it says man, we mean women too, right? I mean, in this particular case, I wish we could leave it all on the men, but sorry. Rather, it's what comes out of a man or woman that makes him or her unclean. It's not the Tesla that's the issue. It's what fuels our need for the Tesla, if you'll forgive the pun. What does having a Tesla do to us? Does it feed our pride, pervert our self-image, distract our focus? A Tesla by itself is just a car. But a Tesla with an improper perspective is an idol. And we all know that I'm using Tesla just as an example. It could be anything. Anyway, moving on. Once again, Jesus takes the disciples away from the crowd. And this is something that's common in the book of Mark. Moments of divine revelation take place in a house removed from the interference and the mixed motives of the crowds. The disciples, we have to understand, have been steeped in the oral tradition from the time they were in whatever passed for diapers in their culture. So the notion that a lifetime of focus on being ritually clean misses the point causes their head to explode. So to them, it would be similar to being in the presence of Aristotle and Eratosthenes when they postulated that the assumed flat earth was actually round. It took some time to recalibrate thinking, and some folks are still recalibrating. So James Edwards says this: their failure to understand is because they are like a dog looking at the pointed finger of its master rather than the object to which the finger points. They are like people looking at the stained glass windows of a cathedral from the outside. Mark's point is to clarify that the essential purpose of the Torah, and in fact the foundation of morality, is a matter of inward purity, inward motive, and intent rather than the external compliance to the rituals of custom. According to this train of thought, the goodness of a deed depends not solely on its doing, but primarily on its intent or the motivation behind it. In other words, you can do a really good thing for the wrong reason, and it's not such a really good thing. So how does this translate to us today? What do you think Mark would say if he were here and was speaking out of this passage? Well, I think there's a couple takeaways. The first is inner awareness is really important. If we're living on autopilot, all is going to go right over our heads without a second thought. And I've spent a lot of my life, most of my life, and some of my current life on autopilot. I've perfected the art of looking like I am something that I am not, with the hope that I might actually be able to fool both you and me into the fact that I am that something. But as I mature, I realize that this was not what I want to be. I want my journey with Jesus to be real, to be honest. I want to really follow Jesus, not just say I do. I've worked hard to develop an inner awareness so I can understand what really is driving me and who I actually am. And I need to continue working on that a lot, because part of this refining journey, it's what I'm going to be on for the rest of my life. We had a secretary in our law firm many years ago, back when we all dressed in suits. It's corporate America, you know. So we would all look like lawyers and professionals. We're more casual now, cut back. But back then, I wore a suit every day, even though I wasn't an attorney, and am not, but was admin. One day, a secretary came in, and she was dressed in a red mini dress, and it had red or large alphabet letters sprinkled all over it, and she was wearing red high-topped Converse sneakers. And to say she was a little bit, she stuck out like a sore thumb would be an understatement. Because I'm management, I called her into my office to discuss the dress code infraction. Her response to my, "What on earth," which is not what I said, but it was close, was this: "I really wished this morning that I was at the beach. So I thought if I dressed like I was going to the beach, it would make me feel like I was there and I would be happy." Now, if I had just listened to this sermon, I would have handled things so differently. But at least she looked at our motivation, and we did that together. And together we determined, you can read between the lines here, this isn't my finest moment, I'll just say. But together, we determined that she was not happy in the law office, and eventually we came to a meeting of the minds, and she got a job as a personal trainer, where she's been working ever since and is very happy. Note how the word "fired" did not come in there. But Paige had inner awareness. She knew why she did what she did. And eventually that inner awareness paved her way to finding what she really wanted to do, and that she was horribly misplaced in a corporate legal environment. Paige and I remain friends. You'll be glad to know that. Do we know why we do what we do? How many times do we act out or turn towards something that is harmful to us because we're trying to be or do something that we were not designed to be or do? Unless we become aware of the roots that drive our behaviors, we're unlikely to find what we're looking for. If we keep trying to find our fulfillment in externals, in other people, the next best gadget, the greener field on the other side of the pasture, we're setting ourselves up for a lifetime of disappointment. Develop inner awareness. Ask yourself, what's behind this? Why do I want that? And what's underneath that longing? Become an archaeologist of your own psyche, willing to do the hard work of digging down to find out what actually is driving your trajectory. So the next is motivations matter. Now, in my humble and biased opinion, I own it, one of the many irritating phrases that have arisen out of corporate speak is, know your why. However, just because it annoys me doesn't make it less true. And that's what we're talking about here. Know why you're doing something. What's your motivation? If my mouth says my highest priority is to follow Jesus and be like him, but my life says I go my own way and do my own thing, whatever pleases me, I would have to say that my motivations are pointing me in a different path than my mouth is. And that's a problem. Part of the maturing process in this life we call Christianity is to begin to notice the disconnect and make corrections. Ask myself if I truly believe what I say I believe. And if I do, what's preventing me from acting like it? That's a really scary conversation to have with yourself, but it's invaluable. It gives us a baseline and a bedrock of belief out of which everything else can be built. And if you find yourself wanting in this conversation, if you find out that honestly you're not what you say you are or would like to be, let God wrestle with you on that. He doesn't really care where you are on your journey as long as you're with him in the moment. Sometimes the problem is that we've become thoroughly divorced, or we have thoroughly divorced our spiritual side from our secular side. I have news for you. There's only one of me. And all of my secular parts and all of my spiritual parts are one. They overlap. There is no secular Jenny and spiritual Jenny, okay? Now, I may live like that. It's because I just don't recognize it. I have found the prayer of examine to be really helpful. It is a simple exercise of looking back through your day, noticing where I felt the presence of God and where I didn't, and noticing if there were any moments where there's a disconnect. The prayer of examine is based on Psalm 139. Search me, O God, know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there are any offensive ways in me and lead me in the way of everlasting. Now, it's really easy to look at the prayer of example like being called into the principal's office and, you know, saying, so what are all the wrong things that I did today? And the stern principal with his ruler in hand tells you. That's not the picture I want you to have. The picture I want you to have is of you crawling into your mother's or your father's lap, someone who is very dear to you, someone who is safe to you. If that's not your mother or father, picture someone else, an uncle, an aunt, a friend, a teacher, someone you love dearly. You crawl into their lap, and they say, how was your day? And you start to tell them how your day was. And you bring up something, and they go, oh, what about that? And you go, oh, yeah, that probably wasn't the best. And they give you a hug and say, so what'd you learn from that? That's the picture I want you to have. God doesn't have a ruler. I've put copies of one version of the examine in the connection counter if you want to grab it on your way out. There's many different versions, and if you don't like this one, go online, find another one, because there's some that are more gentle, some that are more stringent, some are more churchy, some are, you know, there's no wrong way to do it. I've also had it posted in the sermon notes, I hope, and on the app, so if you want a copy of it, it is accessible to you, and I would suggest you try it. And again, if you find yourself thinking of God with a ruler with a stern face on, put the examine down. And just sit there and ask God to reveal his real face to you. Okay? This is not meant to be a hard thing. So the third thing. Our posture should be this. And this will sound very similar to you. And I'm glad Bob Harper is here this morning, because it comes from him. To be relentless in the pursuit of our own spirituality and lavish in our grace towards others. I think we all agree that the denomination I mentioned earlier missed the point. Their focus is on what not to do, to avoid sin at all costs. There was not a lot of discussion of what to do, how to draw closer to God, how to be more like Christ apart from just not doing certain things. Furthermore, the tendency was to grade us on a curve. As long as my outward behavior, looked better than yours, then I was better than you. I was in, you were out. Well, this totally misses the point. If I were to evaluate my own motivations and actions with the rubric that I evaluate yours, and evaluate your motivations and actions, dispensing the blind grace I tend to give myself, now that would be something. But mostly we tend to do the opposite. I let myself slide, but I judge you without mercy. Well, Bob Harper introduced us to that tagline decades ago, and I think it's worth bringing back into our liturgy, into the forefront. Be relentless in the pursuit of our own spirituality, my own spirituality. I'm relentless with my spirituality and lavish in our grace towards others. Lavish in my grace toward all of you. I like that. It keeps me pointed in the right direction, and it keeps me from judging others according to my standards, which I have to admit, left to their own devices, are way higher for you than they are for me. We're all on a journey, and this side of heaven, no one is going to do it perfectly, and no one is going to finish. Our responsibility is to listen to God, to press into God, spend time with God, and in that close proximity, hope that his ways rub off on us. That process is going to look different for each one of us, and we must give one another grace and encouragement to pursue their own journey at the speed that they pursue it. Could be that what God is doing in somebody is not what I think God ought to be doing in that somebody. But I think I need to defer to him. Part of love your neighbor as yourself means to consider how best to encourage them, perhaps as you yourself would like to be encouraged in the same situation. You'll note I've not talked a lot or at all about the list of sins that Jesus mentions. Maybe it's because my background and I resist sin lists. No doubt these things are harmful in terms of your relationship to God and others. We all know that. But the list is not Jesus' point. His point is, what you do comes as a result of what you hold in your heart. And here I'm going to take a quote from one of my favorite movies, Chocolat, from Per Henry. He says, "I think we can't go around measuring our goodness by what we don't do, by what we deny ourselves, what we resist, and who we exclude. I think we've got to measure goodness by what we embrace, what we create, what we include." Well, I'd like to sum this up with a passage from the Gospel of Matthew, and I'll just let it speak to itself for itself. The Pharisee said, "Teacher, of all the laws, which commandment is the greatest?" And Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is nearly as important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The rest of the law, all of the teachings of the prophets, are but variations on these themes." The title of this series is "Who is this man?" And the Jesus we see in Mark 7 is one who is not afraid to confront us when we bend scriptures to our own benefit. Ritual cleanliness is indeed important, but it must be a cleanliness of the heart first and foremost, because all we do proceeds from that. As we move into worship, I wonder if you might ask yourself these questions and keep them in your heart during the week. Who is Jesus to you? Have you become aware of some misconceptions you've held about Jesus and his ways? What do you sense Jesus is inviting you to this morning?